From the Sky News Centre at 6, steelmaker Chorus is mothballing its plant on Teesside. 1,700 jobs will go in the new year. The MP for Redcar, Vera Baird, says it's a gut-wrenching disappointment. And Bob Stainthorpe of the Unite Union says workers leaving the plant feel they've been dealt a hammer blow.
Absolute shock and horror. Devastation to be, is not too small a word for it, to be honest. People are just very, 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 very taken aback, shocked. I've walked around, I've seen people sat crying. It's just absolute shock.
Two 19-year-old rappers who tried to drown a pregnant girl because they thought she stood in the way of their music careers have been given long jail sentences. Police who examined their computers found they'd hatched the plan in a web chat. Parents of under-10s who have a second dose of the swine flu jab are being told to watch their child's temperature. Research found this group is more likely to suffer a fever following the second jab compared with the first. Children in high-risk groups currently receive two half doses of Pandemrix at least 3 weeks apart, which boosts their immune system. The draw for next year's World Cup is underway in South Africa. It's kicked off with a video message from former South African President Nelson Mandela. He says the country is privileged and humbled to be hosting the tournament. South Africans living in London have gathered outside their country's High Commission in Trafalgar Square to celebrate.
This is really beautiful for us, for the World Cup to come into South Africa. We've been waiting for that for so long, and it's another history in the making in South Africa. We are very fortunate for that.
England's cricketers have won the one-day series against South Africa with a bit of help from the weather. The final match in Durban has been rained off without a ball being bowled. It means England win the series 2-1. And in showbiz, the star of the film The Queen has become acting royalty. Dame Helen Mirren has received a Lifetime Achievement Prize at the Women in Film and Television Awards in London. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225 or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free.
I said, and she said, well, that's even better, clap, clap, and with that I hugged her and we hugged. And she was lovely, you're happy cause a red coat lady, you're happy cause a red coat lady, mask in tape, cheek smiling, high and rosy, walking home in the snow. Happy cause a red coat lady, you're happy cause a red coat lady, mask in tape, cheek smiling, high and rosy, walking home in the snow. Happy cause a red coat lady, you're happy cause a red coat lady. Lady, lady, red coat, like what I wrote, like how I spoke, like how I dressed. Thought I was flirting with my boyfriend, he's already my boyfriend. I said, and she said, well, that's even better, clap, clap, and with that I hugged her and we hugged. And she was lovely, you're happy cause the red coat lady, you're happy cause the red coat lady, mask in, taking, smiling, high and rosy, walking home in the snow. Happy cause the red coat lady, you're happy cause the red coat lady, mask in, taking, smiling, high and rosy.
There you go, that's a short, sharp shock right there from Poppy and Friends with a track called Lady Lady. I play that one for you with particular reference to the fact that she will be one of the featured acts on the Bristol Music Showcase next Saturday, the 12th of December, between 1 p.m. and 10:30 p.m. at St. George's on Brandon Hill. It is going to cost you the princely sum of £6 to go along and see all of these fabulous acts, who include Claudia Aurora, Daisy Chapman, Dave Wright, The Organelles, Phil King, Poppy and Friends, SG Isu and the Monaros, who are the headline act of the thing. This is promoted by Jelly Records, the brainchild of our very own Steve Parkhouse, and I cannot recommend strongly enough that you get along there, because you get to see approximately 10 bands for the princely sum of £6. I know I tend to do free what's-ons, But that, I have to say, is Bergen. Anyway, enough about me. Let's move on to free stuff. My name is Billy Quain. If you would like to get in touch with me and mention for me to mention your free stuff that you've got going on anywhere in the city, anytime, then please do email me on billy.quain@hotmail.com. Failing that, you can email the studio, which is studio@bcfm.org.uk. Give us a ring on 955-3721. Or here's a mad idea, you could even send us a text message on 0752 880 2347. I have got a special interview with Steve Parkhouse all about the Bristol Music Showcase playing out on tomorrow's show, my show tomorrow morning between 11 and midday. So tune in for that one. Right, moving onwards from there, I haven't got any more music queued up, you'll be delighted to hear. This is an interesting one. All of this autumn, on the first Wednesday of the month, well, actually, it turns out it's the second Wednesday of the month this time around, there have been a series of free lectures up at the Bristol City Museum, which I think is a fabulous idea. This time round, it's Human Remains, Objects of Study or Ancestors to Bury. This is a lecture being given by Dr. Tiffany Jenkins. So here we go. This is the press release for this one. Cultural sociologist Dr. Tiffany Jenkins explores the ethical questions surrounding museums and the holding and display of human remains. What is respectful treatment? How should they be displayed? Should human remains be repatriated? Dr. Tiffany Jenkins is Arts and Society Director of the Institute of Ideas. Her book, Consenting Human Remains, Contesting Human Remains, Museums and the Crisis of Cultural Authority will be published next year. So that is on Wednesday evening at 7:30 p.m. until 9 p.m. and that's at the City Museum. Don't miss that one because it's well worth going to. Now, there has been a lot going on at the Arnolfini and I've tended to steer clear of it because there has just been so much. It's the 100 days countdown is almost completed now because next weekend everybody is heading for Copenhagen for the climate change. This Saturday, however, there's a very interesting talk by some Americans. It's the part of the Ocean Earth series. It's the Situation Room, Technology Change and Climate Stability. It's been running for 2 weeks. However, there's a discussion tomorrow at 2 p.m. and this is free. Members of Ocean Earth, including Peter Fent and Catherine Griffiths, will be in conversation with Tom Trevor, the Arnolfini director. So if you're feeling a little bit green in your fingers and your toes, get down there for that one. Now, starting next Saturday, the 24th, and it runs for quite a while actually, it's a craftivism festival that they've got going on down there. I'm just going to mention the free events and give you a little bit of an indication what's going on. This is all going on at the Arnolfini. Now then, catching up, there we go, Friday the 11th, so it's 1 week today. Please join us at Arnolfini for a preview of craftivism, where cultural capital sourdough bruschettas will be distributed. Then there's the rosehip trade. Bring your foraged rosehips to the Arnolfini cafe bar to be used as ingredients in exchange for rosehip drink and recipe leaflet. As I said, there's a lot of this stuff going on. These are all the free events. There's Salon Bench, animated by Trevor Pitt. This is the Salon Bench at Noel West. Come along and share the learning and knitting skills of the artist. Then there's Uncraftivism in the auditorium, light studio, meeting room and cafe bar and incidental places. This is also free and it's on Saturday the 12th for free. Uncraftivism is an open event where you can present your own work. Your contribution will not be judged or restricted by a theme or format. You can organise and promote your own event, whether a performance, a talk, a meal, a song or an undefinable event. Visit www.craftivism.net for further details and to add your event to the programme. Confirmed participants so far are Barcamp Bristol, Bristol Knowledge On Conference, Bristol Robotic Lab, Bristol Wireless, Dorkbot Bristol, Jody, the Order of the Black Tulip, Matt Jackson, Rui Guerra and Zucanian. There's a lot going on. There's tree planting party. There is a civic inauguration of the knitting salon. Then on Saturday the 9th of January, this is after Christmas, there's DIY Shades of Bristol. So artist Claire Thornton leads an eco-painting mix in the Day of Light studio at Arnolfini. Experiment with natural pigments, traditional paint recipes to create your own shades of Bristol. Right, I will come back to that close to the time because it runs for after Christmas as well. Now, finally on the free stuff. Tomorrow, I would recommend, oh, it's not free, in fact, I beg your pardon, next Wednesday, this is free, the Bristol University New Music Ensemble, directed by Niamh Farwell, it's making up of this leading student performers drawn from across the university. You were invited to join them for a concert of new works from modern classics to student commissions performed to the highest standards at the Victoria Rooms at 1:15. Tomorrow evening, you've got the Bristol University Chamber Orchestra, and they're doing a programme including Colday and Mendelssohn. £5 for that one. Now, final free event, Art for Amnesty. This... come and join us at our art auction to raise money for Amnesty International and local Bristol projects at the Watershed tomorrow, Saturday the 5th of December. Viewing starts at 2 p.m. and the auction begins at 5 p.m. It's with Ed Rising from Sotheby's. To donate art or find out more, visit us at amnesty.org.uk/Bristol. That's free, but you know, you might be tempted to put your hand in your pocket and start buying some stuff. Now then, Tony was talking about me being a recession buster. How's about this one from the Bristol Old Vic? Next Thursday, the 10th of December, it's the Actor Scratch Night, 10x3. I'll give you a little bit of the press release on this. 10x3 is a unique chance to see new performers as they get up on their feet for the first time and then have the unique opportunity to discuss the work with the actors over a post-performance drink in the bar. That's the benefit for the audiences. For the actors, the benefits are 10x3 is a bare stage for actors to try out in front of an audience new directions and new challenges with a speech, monologue or script. If you are an actor who has a script you would like to try at 10x3, contact Sharon at bristol-oldvic.co.uk for further details. That will cost you £3. I think I might go along to that, actually. It sounds great. Now, this Sunday... very interesting project going on at St. George's. It doesn't cost very much money. I think it's about £3 for children and it's something about a tenner for adults. It's called 4,000 Winters. I beg your pardon. It's the recommended show by Venue Magazine. Don't miss 4,000 Winters. It braves snow, polar bears and princesses in a soul-warming glue vine of words and music. A trip through the winter stories and the music of the fringes of Europe. Presented by master storyteller Sally Pom-Clayton and Jogleresa. Something very different for your Christmas celebrations. Belinda Sykes is the voice. Director Sally Pom-Clayton is the storyteller. And then she's got a selection of musicians behind her, including Gene Kelly. And if it's the same Gene Kelly that I'm thinking of, not Singing in the Rain Gene Kelly, but Gene Kelly that I grew up with, she also played the harp on all of the Lord of the Rings soundtracks. It's thrilling and haunting, according to the Times. So there you go. Bring along the kids. It really is fabulous, but it's recommended that they're... don't be too much less than 9 years old. Now, as I've mentioned, the Bristol Music Showcase is coming up on Saturday the 12th of December, and I won't talk to you any more about that. Finally, I'm going to just plug in to what we've got going on at Colston Hall and a little bit of what's going on at the Cube, because Tony is making funny faces at me through the glass saying, I want to get back into my studio, please. Would you stop with the chat? So I'm just going to whiz through this. The Bristol Eco Show launch is on Wednesday the 9th of December between 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. It's at the Create Centre Auditorium on Smeaton Road. The launch activities include... well, I'll give you a little bit of the blurb first. It's using artists to mobilise a city to dramatically reduce its environmental impact and increase conviviality and positive connection to nature. Now, that's fairly highfalutin language, just to say get on your bicycle, I think, and, you know, turn the central heating down a notch or two and put on a jumper. There's an explanation of the vision and strategy for 2010 Eco Shows. There's a flash movie with music of the Eco Shows pilot in Southville showing how artist Annie Davenport engages with a community group to move from an aspiration to a community garden. There's extracts from Steve Taylor's film The Green Heart of Africa, live music and networking over Nibble with Eco Show's exhibitants. Participants from Redland, Hartcliffe, Withywood, Redcliffe meet each other. There's Eco Show artist Pablo Perez will set out his ideas for a second pilot. June Burrow, of the Pyrian Centre explains wider efforts to create prosperity and social inclusion in Bristol. And there's a chance for environmentally focused artists to meet each other and the public. Now, you do need to RSVP this one. If you would like to go along to it, RSVP to Big Bromo, BIGBROMO at yahoo.co.uk. That's all lowercase, all one word. Big Bromo, BIGBROMO at yahoo.co.uk. Now, the Colston Hall, Hall 2, which is where I was last week, which is why you didn't hear me. I was interviewing Bob Brossman, are doing a folk season, which is being promoted, I think, by Midnight Mango Productions, who are based in Somerset. Tonight, you can go along and see Lau. They're the winners of the best group of BBC Two Folk Awards for 2008 and 2009. They are comprised of Chris Drever, Martin Green and Aidan O'Rourke, and they play Scots Gaelic traditional music. It's fabulous stuff. stuff. It's traditional, obviously, with a slightly more recent twist on it. Supporting those, Cole Stacey. Cole, who's now 24, and he is from the West Country, I gather. Now, tomorrow night, this is a big one for me, Tommy Emmanuel, who is apparently the best guitarist in the world. He's a two-time Grammy nominee, Tommy Emmanuel. He has mesmerised both fellow musicians and audiences alike with a professional career that spans over four decades. He's a household name in his native Australia. Tommy has garnered hundreds of thousands of loyal fans worldwide. Tommy's unique style, he calls it simply fingerstyle, is akin to playing guitar, the way a pianist plays the piano, using all 10 fingers. He's got four platinum and three gold albums and many awards. He sets the standard for others to emulate. So, if you're really a big fan of the six-stringed discipline, then go along and see him. Supporting him is Nick Price. And he's also from Australia. There's lots more stuff, but that's all coming up next week. There's Paul Berry and Fred Thackett, who are one part of, they're two parts of Little Feet, actually. They're quite a well-known folk group there on Wednesday evening. So that's what's going on at Coulson Hall, Hall 2. I've neglected an awful lot of what's going on in Coulson Hall, Hall 1, because you have to pay big money for that, and they haven't really refurbished it to my standards. I will say, however, that the Bristol Bach Choir on Friday the 18th and Saturday the 19th of December are playing at St. George's at 7:30. You do have to pay money for this, I'm afraid, but it's a very, very nice opportunity and a very nice venue to witness a joyful mixture of seasonal music and carols, including recent works by Sir John Taverner, Jonathan Dove and Howard Goodall, interspersed with more traditional fare, all leavened with now celebrated Bach choir readings, both humorous and thoughtful. It's a perfect start to the Christmas season. Clear your own pipes in this magnificent setting and join the choir in raising the roof of St. George's for the essential Christmas carol experience. I would recommend that. Now, speaking of Christmas carol experiences, you cannot go through Christmas without going along to the theatre for a little bit of, well, pantomime, I call it, but actually the Tobacco Factory and the Bristol Old Vic are veering away from traditional pantomime this year slightly. Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, it's a brand new retelling of the much-loved folktale, because Travelling Light have gotten involved with the Tobacco Factory Theatre Company, and they are doing Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves. It's not cheap. Full price tickets, £12, concessions are £8. If you're going in the week either side of Christmas and New Year, full price tickets are going to cost you 15 and concessions are 45. There we go. Now, the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School are presenting at the Redgrave Theatre Dick Whittington from the winning team who brought you Aladdin. It's music and, written and directed by Clive Hayward, and the music is by John Telfer. That's well worth going to see. Now, slightly closer to home, the St. Ursula's Players present the hilarious farcical comedy Tom, Dick and Harry at the Newman Hall. Last night is tonight. It's £7 for adults, £4 for children. Hansel and Gretel are playing at the Theatre Royal in Bristol. They open today. And they're running until the 23rd. This is a co-production with the Knee High Theatre Company based in Cornwall, who are always well worth going to see. Now, I mentioned I was going to mention the Cube. Tomorrow evening, Sunday evening, I beg your pardon, if you feel the inclination, you can go along and see, well, one of the seminal recording artists of the late 1990s in the electronica field. They are the now reduced Broadcast, whom I'm a huge fan of, led by bass player James Cargill, whom some of you may or may not recognise as being the brother of Bill Cargill, who cut a strut across the Bristol music scene in the late 1990s and early zeros. Go along and see that. That's at the Cube, and I think it's going to cost you £6. With that in mind, and the fact that Christmas is being thrust upon us again this year, I'm going to play you a little Christmas song. This is Peter Murphy with Tom Waits. I hope you enjoy it.
I can hang from the tree. I need no excuse to end my misery. This holiday season is all the more reason to die.
Oh, pull up a stool and an ear to a fool who once found some solace in the season of Yule. This holiday season is all the more reason to cry.
I put on my mittens, one green and one red, and I walk alone
where they bury the dead. The snow falls as I grieve. It's a gothic death rock Christmas Eve.
The bottle is empty. The sleigh has a flat. The stripper in my bed is ugly and fat. Her tassels are tangled, and what's worse, my jingle won't jangle.
This time of the year makes me sick to my guts.
All this good cheer is a pain in the nuts.
When it's your career to be down in the dumps, tidings of comfort and joy really suck.
I feel like St. Nicholas is pulling my leg.
This thing we call Christmas is a sorry black plague.
This holiday season
is all the more reason. All the more reason to die.
A bit of a grim sounding song, Billy. All the more reason to die at Christmas. How depressing. Anyway, why did you choose that one?
Well, you know, it's just the rampant consumerism. We've had this email now, and my family, I'm from a very large family. My brother lives in Spain, and last year he thought it would be a great idea if we did this Kris Kringle thing, which apparently is an American idea. You pick names out of a hat who you decide to buy your presents for, thusly saving money.
And Secret Santa.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And it means also that you don't have to carry back bagfuls of tat that you're never going to use again, because, you know, if you're spending, you can spend decent money on one present, or you can spend a lot of money on several not-so-good presents. And I think the idea, that was the argument. Anyway, so this afternoon, myself and the missus sat down, and we've tried to work out who's kringling, who's not, who we need to buy presents for, who will a card do for, who can we give alcoholic presents to, which is basically shifting the contents of your wine rack to somebody else's wine rack, who do we need to go and see in person. And to be honest with you, it's becoming very pressurised. Christmas is no longer a time of celebration and spirituality. It's actually just a lot of hassle.
Can't you do it without the presents? Can you just do it as a family thing?
Ah, I'm glad you said that. My baby sister said, give some money to charity for me.
Hmm. Well, I lived in Poland a few years ago with some very humble people, and they did exactly what you did, because there was no point everybody going out to buy presents. Everybody's on the dole. They've got no money. And, you know, basically, they just kringled, as you say, and it was one of the nicest Christmases I've ever had, because all of that consumerism was just taken out of it. There was no way people were going to spend money on presents. They didn't have any money, so they just got a lot of food in and had a good family knees up.
Exactly. It probably spoke to each other as well.
Indeed.
Okay, just as a sort of story left over from our news review earlier on, which we didn't have time for, time to call the greedy banker's bluff. Now, one of the things that's happened this week is there's been a kind of showdown, really, hasn't there, between the board of the Royal Bank of Scotland, which we own, by the way, and the Treasury. Martin, do you want to just kick off here with a little description of the showdown and which way we should go on this one?
Well, I mean, the Lord Miners, who's the city minister, was berating the Royal Bank of Scotland board because they're intending to pay out large bonuses before Christmas. I mean, it looks like the banks as a whole are about to pay out 5,000 bankers are about to get bonuses of more than £1 million each. Just think about the money involved in this. And even in banks which are not directly owned by the government, the whole banking system is underwritten by the taxpayer. So in actual fact, we do, in fact, own these institutions. And when the government suggested that they might ban the board from paying out these bonuses, the board said, well, we're so upset with that, we might have to resign. And I'm glad to see that Vince Cable on Question Time last night said, well, let them resign then. Frankly, they should be sacked. They shouldn't be there anyway. Yeah, we should nationalise the banking system properly. that we've got to actually recognise that it does belong to the people, to the state.
But by buying
not
a majority,
going back to private banking.
But by buying a majority shareholding, as we've done in the Royal Bank of Scotland, surely effectively it has been nationalised.
Well, it has, but we're not exerting any power over them. They're basically running it as a private sector money printing machine instead of as a public bank. And the Labour government is not doing what it should do. It's, if you're going to nationalise the bank, you've got to take it over and you've got to decide what you want to do with it. There's a huge problem at the moment because we're trying to resurrect the private banking system, and that's the wrong way to go. We've got to accept that it is public and then start thinking about what we want to do with it.
So when Fred the Shred retired with £715,000 a year in his back pocket to play golf and buy Mercedes's with, the Treasury itself actually appointed the new board, did they not, to RBS?
Yes, but what they've appointed is kind of private sector insiders who are going to run... what they're trying to do is get it back to being a proper private sector bank. So they've got private sector insiders to try and get that done. But they're going in the wrong direction. They have not faced up to the fact that we're not going back to private banking. It's been around for a few hundred years. It's finished. And we've got to move into a different sector, a different way of looking at it and thinking about it.
So the Treasury, just clarify this for me, are now facing some sort of a revolt from the people that they... you know, put into these jobs in the first place, whenever it was, earlier this year.
Yes, well, the government didn't actually put anybody, you know, they didn't really take control of the situation. They wanted to be at arm's length. Yeah? Uh-huh. So they didn't want to nationalise. You know what forced the British to nationalise was the Irish nationalisation. The Irish government just said, right, we've got a problem here, and they didn't tell the EU, they didn't tell Britain, they just went ahead and nationalised their banks.
Well, you say
that forced the issue.
I can't agree with you on that, actually, because they didn't nationalise the banks. All the Irish government said was, yes, we will underwrite all of your savings.
That's right. That's right. But I mean, that is effective. I mean, what they've done is exactly the same as the British. They've underwritten it, but they've not taken control of it. Yeah.
After a fashion, but I would say that the Irish government isn't appointing any bankers to sit on boards and that sort of stuff. And also, I think with this RBS thing, it's not in actual fact the board members who are getting the massive bonuses here.
No.
It's the money traders in the city.
The same employees. They're making money on this bubble in the stock market.
Yes, these investment bankers, because the stock market, since I think it was March the 18th, has bounced back up something like 30% from the lows.
That's your quantitative easing, and that's all that money that the government's chucked at it, isn't it? Has made another bubble for the bankers, but we're hearing about Chorus sacking another 1,500 people.
I mean,
we need that money to be spent in the real economy, not propping the flipping banks up. And the banks have got to be, in an orderly fashion, basically closed down as private institutions. You've got to cancel the debts, sack most of the managers, restructure the whole thing.
So can you see, envisage a scenario where the banks will have more intent government involvement with them?
It's inevitable.
But they'll just up sticks and they'll say, all right, we'll go to Bahrain.
Ultimately, the three big players in this are going to be New York, London and Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And if they all decide that they're going to pursue a certain kind of a policy, I mean, obviously Britain can't do it on its own any more than Ireland could.
Yeah? No, absolutely
but
not.
But there's got to be across the board. The fact is that the private banking system is in fact in the hands of the state all over the world. It's been in the hands of the state in Japan since the 1990s.
Yeah? But they've been struggling with...
Well, of course, because what they're trying to do, the misconception they're trying to do, they're trying to resurrect the dead private banking system.
One of the things you're missing out completely, Martin, one of the things you're missing out completely here is the fact that if we do sack these private bankers, then there's going to be a complete flight of these people from the country. So we're not going to be talking about the City of London as a power. Just let me finish. I'm fading you down, actually, yeah? if the City of London then sort of goes down the world stage as a banking centre, and all these people are leaving Britain for the continent, for the Eurozone, we're going to end up as a kind of little third world country, aren't we?
Listen, the thing about nationalising banks is what banks that are supported by the government are much more solid than private banks. So if you've got nationalised banking system, people will go to that with their money. Yeah, that's what happened when Ireland did it. All of the money flowed to Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is why the City of London then had to push for Britain to step in and nationalise and so on. Now, in other words, once you've got a solid nationalised banking system, the private banking system withers on the vine. Yeah, because nobody wants to put their money in a private bank which is going to go bust and it's not protected by the government. Now, that means in actual fact that it's quite easy to kill off the private banks, and then these people just have to go down the job centre like everybody else.
You say that. I you keep referring to Dublin in this whole argument and discussion. What I would suggest is that Dublin set a precedent that should never, ever, ever be followed ever again, because the vested interests and the sheer wanton greed and corruption that was inherent in the whole system there, including this chap from one of the main three Irish banks, whose name escapes me now, Flaherty or Farrell, I think his name was, he was the MD of this bank, and he wrote himself loans to the tune of 90 million euros to speculate on property.
Where's the
affordable housing opportunities there?
Obviously, there's been lots of corruption, not just in Ireland, in Britain and the US as well. I mean, we've got to actually clean out the system completely. We need monetary reform. We need to change the way we think about what credit is in our society and what role it should play.
Absolutely. If you look at the French and the German models, first of all, the French and German banks weren't handing out anything near 100% mortgages. You needed to stump up at least a 30% deposit.
The real problem, Billy, is not so much the mortgages, it's the CDOs and all these complex derivative instruments that they've created.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That the shadow banking system is basically, they guess, something between 10 and 100 times bigger than the actual banking system we can see. Now, they should never have been allowed to set up an unregulated banking system outside the regulations.
And Gordon Brown was perfectly happy for
that. Of course, and so were all of the other politicians, because the politicians are funded by business interests. That's how they've made their policy. I mean, it's certainly true in Ireland.
Oh, absolutely.
I know the Fianna Fáil government was in the pocket of these people, as you know.
Yes.
And that's why they let them do it.
The argument I would come back to you with was that Gordon Brown was coining in an awful lot of corporation tax for, nine and a half years.
It's a pact with the devil, isn't it?
Yes.
And you should have realised that this was, nothing's for nothing. And if you're getting something off these guys, but what's the payoff? Yeah,
so
and now they've found out.
Do you foresee that we're going to start a downward trend now? The Bank of England guy,
Mervyn King.
Correct. Mervyn King has now said he's going to have to start putting interest rates back up again.
They're talking like that in order to try and stabilise the bond market and all the rest of it.
Yes, but he's cutting off the flow of money that has been going in secretly. This quantitative easing is being cut off now. Interest rates are going to start creeping back up again, which means that the banks are going to have to start creeping their mortgage rates back up again. Are we going back onto the downside?
I think there's every possibility. I'm not wishing it to happen, but there's every possibility of a catastrophic crash here, much bigger than 1929.
Mm-hmm.
We should never, it's the old Irish thing, if I was you, I wouldn't start from here. if you want to go somewhere, I wouldn't start from here. We shouldn't be in this mess.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if they'd managed things properly. I mean, this is the whole Reagan-Thatcher era deregulation. You know how it worked in Ireland, where they just opened the doors and had all this foreign money coming in.
Yes.
And so on and so forth. We should never have done all of that. We actually managed to manage the international capitalist economy quite sensibly from 1945 to 1973 with a very controlled, measured system.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually worked. And then we've thrown all that out of the window, and then we're surprised that we're back where we started.
So where do we go from here? Do we start a New Deal kind of a programme like happened in the States?
Absolutely.
Do we renationalise the railways for a start?
Exactly.
That would solve the steelworks and red card. That would put an awful lot of unemployed people back in the job market.
We've got to have a plan for where we want to be in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, 15 years' time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got to actually put it into practice. It's what we did in World War II. It's what you have to do in an emergency situation.
It sounds to me like the government isn't they're not getting much, to use the Americanism, bang for their buck with all of this money that they're
underwriting.
No, they're not.
What they've done is they've just underwritten further gambling and nonsense. Yeah, this is your last bit of money, and we want you to do X, Y, and Z. But they haven't. What's really shocking is that they haven't made any kind of plan or preparation for this situation when they nationalised the British banks. The top Treasury officials had to stay there for 48 hours and they had to bring in curry so that they could write up a plan. That's ridiculous. The Treasury in Britain should have had a plan ready to go, from the top drawer.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of thing was always likely to happen. In 1998, we saw the crash in Southeast Asia. We saw the Mexican crisis in 1983. There's been a series of these crises, and each time they've gone, we've got the thing back together again, and then they've gone back to the same old ways. It's not as if we've not had warning that this was coming.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they should have had a plan ready to go, and they've been caught absolutely on the back foot, and Brown as well. They don't expect the banks. Can the banks just collapse like that? So, well, yes, they can. Of course they can. And you should have known that. You're a clever guy. Why didn't you know that?
Oh, I wish I had such healthy cynicism as you have.
Hey, guys. Marina Morris is waiting in the wings to do this piece about Rasputin. But I'd like, just before she does that, Billy, could you just tell us whether you think give us a little sort of crystal ball prediction. Will the board of Royal Bank of Scotland still be there at the middle of next week?
Yes, they most likely will. They'll come to some kind of a fudged compromise, and you know, everybody, there'll be a little bit of media interest in it for about 10 days and then it will just dissipate.
Martin?
I would like to think that they will be forced to resign and will start talking sensibly about what we really should be doing. I mean, this is a golden opportunity. They should be sacked anyway.
Well, they may not be forced to resign.
Well, then off they go.
if they're sent in their letters of an offer, maybe they'll get a letter back saying, thank you very much, yes, we would like you to resign.
That's what we should do.
Okay.
Before we leave it, Tony, I'd just like to mention, Alistair Darling has been mute for the last 4 months, or am I just the only person who's noticed that?
Well, you're not the only person that's noticed it. Also, he does seem to be slightly startled. Every time I've seen him on the television, Darling seems to be like sort of looking up at the ceiling as if he's not quite sure.
I just don't get it. I mean, he's the go-to guy for all of these problems, and he doesn't appear to be coming up with much.
Do you think he's got the dynamism that's needed for there to be chance?
It's not a question of the dynamism. I just think maybe after he made a few initial little fluffs early on when the wheels started to come off, Gordon Brown, or somebody at number 10, using the thick of it analogy, said, right, keep him away from all forms of media. Sit in your office and we'll take care of this.
Lovely. Okay, now Marina Morris is joining us, and this week we're having a look at a little bit of Russian history, and particularly the Russian Revolution and a certain man named Rasputin.
Ефимович Распутин was a mystic who became close to Alexandra, the last Tsaritsa of Russia. Rasputin was viewed by many as a dangerous, power-hungry charlatan and is reputed to have survived several attempts to kill him before he was finally assassinated in December 1916. In 1906, Nicholas II and Alexander, the last Russian Tsar at Tsaritsa, were persuaded to let Rasputin look at their son, Alexei. He was thought to suffer from hemophilia, but his illness was a state secret. Mysteriously, Rasputin knew all about it. Stranger still, when he prayed over the young Alexei, the boy's hemorrhage stopped. The Tsaritsa fell firmly under Rasputin's spell. Accounts of Rasputin's death are mixed up this legend. They usually boil down to the mad monk being almost impossible to kill. He was lured to the Yusupov's family palace by cross-dressing party boy Count Felix Yusupov. Rasputin is supposed to have consumed poisoned bonbons and booze that the conspirators gave him. He didn't die as expected. Then he was shot 4 times, beaten, wrapped in linen sheet, and thrown from a bridge into the river Neva. The conspirators were concerned that he wasn't dead. The cause of death on his death certificate was hypothermia. People, Rasputin is of little current interest, other than as tourism attraction and brand of Rasputin tea and Russian Rasputin vodka. A new Russian book and film claims that the infamous Siberian mystic was murdered as a part of British government plot to depose Tsar Nicholas II and to replace him a bisexual Grand Prince Dmitry. Also, Rus in Russian means one, Putin something else.
Thank you. not too long ago.
He was big and strong, in his eyes a flaming glow.
Most people look at him with terror and with fear.
But to Moscow chicks, he was such a lovely dear.
And his hunger for power became known to more and more people. The demands to do something about this outrageous man became louder and louder.
And that was Boney M with the famous Rah-Rah Rasputin. I don't know what to say about this or what real comment to make, other than that Rasputin's time in close to power in Russia and his death was the beginning of what was a very tragic century for the Russian people. Revolutions do happen. And they're not always pretty, and they don't always end up where you'd like to be. And I think we're in dangerous times now, as we were before the First World War, where the possibility of things going off the rails is very much in front of us. And we should learn the lessons of history.
So, do you think the people that started the Russian Revolution it ended up rather different than they thought it was going to be?
Well, revolution eats its own children, as they said of the French Revolution. I mean, there was all sorts of glorious ideals, and it turned into a huge mess. So we've got to be very aware of the dangers of that kind of way of thinking about things. But change has to come. Yeah, and if it doesn't come easily, it comes hard. And there's a real danger with economic collapse all over the world that we're going to see more, bad leaders leading people in the wrong direction, creating hatred and war and conflict, and it's a real danger.
That's certainly true for our own English Civil War here, isn't it? That when people set out on the journey that was going to be, you know, sort of taking on the king, that they really did think that there was going to be a completely different system come out of it afterwards, and there was talk of a Commonwealth and this kind of thing, whereas actually what happened was really nothing like that.
No, I mean, and life is full of unpleasant surprises, so let's be prepared for the unpleasant surprises to come.
And whilst you're being prepared for the unpleasant surprises to come, you might be wondering about happiness, and you might be wondering why you're too happy, or whether you're really happy in this credit crunch. Now, Marina Morris is joining us again now. Marina, you've been looking into happiness again this week, and I think it's good that you're concerned with this issue, and it comes back every once in a while.
It's a very important question, really. The UK is one of the wealthy European countries and has one of the highest levels of average per capita income, according to the statistic from the World Bank, higher than Belgium, France, Germany or Italy. During the past 50 years, the Britain has become richer, healthier, have better homes, cars, foods, holidays than they did half a century ago. British male life expectancy is now 75 and females 80. During the past century, male life expectancy has increased by 27 years and females by 31. The government predicts British male life expectancy will rise to 79 and female to 83 by 2025. This is a very good achievement if you measure well-being by prosperity and longevity. But do people believe that they have never had it so good? How happy are we? One in six people of the UK 60 million population suffers from depression or chronic anxiety. One person in every 88, one in 20 people over 65, one in five people over 80 has a form of dementia. Forecast shows dementia will affect the lives of around one in three people, either as a sufferer or as a care or relative, by 2051. One person with late onset dementia care cost an average of 25,500 per year. This impressive statistic indicates Britain's big problem, mental health, especially as we age. A 2006 University of York survey found that UK children are the unhappiest of any wealthy European country. Unhappiness is a very wealthy country. Is this a paradox of prosperity? Or perhaps it's our nature to be unhappy? Statistics show that countries with a much lower level of income are much happier than more materialistic societies. What is the government attitude and what has the government done to address these issues? The government has Professor Lord, popularly known as the happiness czar, that urged the government to fundamentally rethink the goals of public policy, to take account of the fact that there is more to life than money. A Labour peace since 2000, he has been able to influence first Blair's administration and then Brown's into making his happiness agenda government policy. He speaks cheerfully of how the world will be in figures in job titles in government departments, how the new government policy include commitments to well-being, how the Office of National Statistics is developing the measurement of well-being, how at both social and emotional aspects of learning program is devoted to making secondary school children focused on well-being. Professor Lord visited the Himalayas Kingdom of Bhutan, whose citizens have an average income 1/7 of that of a UK citizen. He found the people much happier than people with a more materialistic ethos. The National Health Service is currently implementing the recommendation of Professor Lord, is training 10,000 therapists across the UK to expand the menu of addressing mental health problems. Whether this level of expenditure will be resilient to possible National Health Service budget cuts is, however, questionable. Today plans are going to Bristol City Council Resources Scrutiny Commission to cut £2 million from the budget that provides care for the old, unwell, disabled and mentally ill. A necessary remedy to balance its budget, just day after it has announced the multi-million pounds cost of its plan to hold football matches in a possible British-hosted World Cup in 2018. A bid which the UK, let alone Bristol, might not even win. With this level of state support, perhaps self-help is the only dependable alternative. The happiness agenda has many unanswered questions. What do the people of Bristol think about mental problems and happiness?
Thanks, Marina. Now, Martin, did you want to chip in there and give us your two halfpence on that?
Isn't there a Vox Pop?
Yep.
You want me to speak first, yeah? Happiness clearly is more important than wealth. I mean, you know, everybody says this, but your health is your wealth. Yeah, it's more, if you get a serious illness, you suddenly realise that money doesn't buy everything. There's been a study done recently called The Spirit Level. I've forgotten the name of the professor who wrote the book, but he's done it's a very thorough, statistical-based book, and he's pointed out that more equal societies are much happier than unequal societies. So he's looked across the whole world, and it doesn't even matter at what level you're equal. I mean, if you're in an unequal society, there's tension, stress, hierarchy, you know, people are worried. The more equal a society is, the happier people are, the less mental problems they have, and so on. And this is all done with statistics. It's called the spirit level. And if people are interested, if you just do a search, you'll find material about this book. It's been very, very influential on the thinking of politicians and others in the last year or so.
Okay, and as you mentioned, Marina has been out to talk to people on the streets of Bristol about happiness, whether they think they're really happy during the recession, and we'll be having another chat about this after we've heard this 5 minutes or so of happiness vox pops.
The National Health Service is trying to recruit and train 10,000 therapists across the UK to improve happiness as a part of the mental health agenda. Is this a good use of scarce resources?
Well, happiness is important, I think, because the alternative is not so good. But, I mean, I'm not sure that people should be spending lots of money on this. I don't really get how spending money on therapists would make people happy. It makes them miserable, doesn't it? I think British people are generally pretty happy, even with all the things we've got to put up with. But it's okay, generally.
I think our problem has got... is rooted in the fact that we're very materialist. If you think about the 80s, that's when it really began. We're very materialist society, and values have gone, family values have gone. People don't care about people very much. They very much care about themselves. The mental health system is fundamentally in a bad way. We don't take care of people we've got in the system. The people who are already in the system need to learn how to be with other people. I mean, I do know very much about it. I've seen it on a daily basis. And we don't know how to listen to people. The people at the top need to learn how to listen. We need to equalize things out, right? People who are different shouldn't be put away. People who are sensitive shouldn't be put away. They should be incorporated, listened to, and have their needs met, actually. It's really fundamentally about not listening to what people need.
I think it's very important. In fact, the now mental health situation, I think, is very much underused and very much underestimated.
Happiness is very important, yes. Therapists, I don't think... I don't know about therapists, I think... Make them all do sports, that'll keep them happy.
Yeah, I think if you're training up people for important things like that, then yeah, I think at the end of the day, it is, like, definitely, definitely.
What does happiness mean to you?
This is getting very deep, isn't it? What is happiness? It's difficult to put into words, I think. It's just a general, you know, as long as everything's going okay, I think, you know, people are generally happy, I am anyway.
What are you? That's a very hard question. I think we've all been hurt. We all need to be able to accept ourselves, accept who we are. None of us have received enough love. We there are many cultures we could learn so much from. I mean, I have Muslim neighbors. They have a wonderful attitude towards neighbors. They really care about their neighbors. We don't. We could learn about caring from the Muslims, for instance. That's just only one thing. You know, everybody's got to take a damn good look at themselves. You know, everybody's been hurt, and really, people need to be able to express themselves. That's why we have a mental health system, because it's not accepted that if you express yourself differently, it's okay. We should be able to embrace everybody.
Accepting my situation as I live it, and treating everyone as I would wish to be treated.
Happiness to me means having enough money to get the things I need, be healthy, make sure my family are happy and healthy, having free time and family time and my time, and being successful in my business.
Well, just enjoying the everyday life, do you know what I mean? Just taking each day as it comes, and yeah, so making sure you're happy all the time.
Are you happy? And what things can make you happy? We're a divided society, and I think that's probably at the root of people's unhappiness, actually. There is enough resources in the world for everybody to have enough to eat, to have shelter, clothing, and the basics. There is enough resources, but the resources are very badly divided. We need to make a level plane. And we need to start, you know, in this country, actually.
Of course I want to be happy. Am I happy? Yes, generally yes. A little bit stressed at work, but yes, I want to be happy. I'm happy, yes.
Do I want to be happy? Do I want to be happy? Yes, I think that I should aspire to being happy, yes.
What things can make you happy?
People make you happy. If your situation is not too horrible with work and stuff, general feeling of well-being and stuff, and health and not poverty, not, I was going to say health and wealth, but don't have to be wealthy, just, you know, not in too bad a situation, but even then, it's all an attitude of mind, I think.
What things can make me happy? I don't know, really, just enjoying what you're doing, do you know what I mean? Not having money problems, that sort of thing, so yeah, just making sure you've always got money to do whatever you need to do, you know what I mean? Wear nice clothes, that sort of thing. So, yeah, definitely.
So there's some people in Bristol expressing their views about happiness there, collected by Marina Morris earlier this week. I think it's quite interesting that there's quite a lot of people picking up on this idea of unfairness and not fair sharing of resources, a divided society. I mean, those are the kind of things that the book, The Spirit Level, that I mentioned earlier, is homing in on. And as I said, the interesting thing about the book is it compares different societies. Say Japan's quite an equal income structure, and they have much less suicide and much happier people than countries with big inequalities of wealth. Some of the unhappiest people are in the United States of America because of all of the pressure to be materially successful and the punishment for not being materially successful and all the things that go with that.
Well, one of the ladies there was talking to Marina, said that we should start in Britain. We should make an example in Britain, and other parts of the world will follow us. So do you think that's realistic?
Well, I think we are a northern European country of a medium size. We ought to be more like our other northern European neighbours, places like Denmark and Sweden and Finland, where people are generally happier because they have a kind of a family approach to society. Nobody's left out. Everybody's included. There's a lot of discussion and democracy. There's a much fairer sharing of incomes. And that's the basis of happiness. People are what make people happy, and we need more human interactions and less competitive backbiting.
Well, thanks again, Marina, for a really interesting vox pop there, and that's all we've got time for this week. Coming up next is the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2, where we review the week's news and discuss some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world. So after the news, we've got Somali Youth. If you want a story discussed, have questions about this evening's programme, or would like to suggest a topic or guest for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Liberal Democrat City Councillor for Lawrence Hill, Sue O'Donnell, and our resident Old Labour pundit and Oxford economist, and today, 50-year-old birthday boy, Martin Summers. The reports on community cohesion and Rasputin the Mad Monk came courtesy of Marina Morris. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including last week's report on mobile masts, or 2 weeks ago, and wireless networks, and find out what's scheduled for forthcoming weeks by going to bcfm.org.uk and clicking on presenters or podcasts to find my page. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. We have about 60 million people in Britain and 60 million acres of land, so while it might seem there's not enough resources to go around, that's only because soulless banks and big business controllers have taken far more than their fair share. All we have to do is make sure that 60 million acres is shared out fairly, and with modern technology not controlled by a greedy elite, we can all live quite happily together. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Are listening to BCFM 93.2.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.